Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Hello and welcome to Matters of Life and Death. I'm Tim Wyatt. Unfortunately, my dad and I were not able to record a new episode this week, so instead we're bringing you a classic episode from the MOLAD Vault. Medical Assistance in Dying, known as MAID, is Canada's euthanasia program. It began in 2016 with a Supreme Court decision, but has since rapidly expanded and liberalised. The latest battleground is over mental health. The Canadian government has committed to changing its laws so that people suffering solely from mental health conditions can still request doctors end their lives, but in January was forced to delay the rollout of this for a second or perhaps even a third time over concerns the healthcare system was not equipped to properly assess a new wave of mentally unwell people for an assisted death. In the face of this news, it seemed like a good idea to return to an episode we first broadcast over a year ago, featuring a Christian psychiatrist from Canada. In it, we discuss Canada's slippery slope since euthanasia was legalised and what it is like to practice medicine in a system where vulnerable, unwell people can now be offered a quick death rather than compassionate, long-term treatment. Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Watt and I'm joined by my dad, John. Hi, Dad.
Hi, it's good to be here.
And we're really pleased to say we have a guest this week, dialing in all the way across the Atlantic from Canada. That's Sephora Tang. Hi, Sephora.
Hello.
We're really excited to have you on the show today. You're a psychiatrist. You're going to be helping us talk a little bit about the situation around assisted suicide in Canada. Do you want to just briefly explain to listeners who you are? What do you do in the day job? How did you first get involved in this whole conversation around euthanasia?
Sure. Thank you for the introduction and thank you for having me on this podcast. So I work in Ottawa, capital of Canada. I'm a psychiatrist and also an assistant professor at the University of Ottawa. I work at the Ottawa Hospital, and I mainly receive referrals in the outpatient clinic. So we have an urgent care clinic receiving referrals from our emergency department and from people who have been recently discharged from the inpatient unit, as well as acting as a consultant service to other medical specialties within the hospital that needs a psychiatric assessment in the outpatient department.
Brilliant. And so I suppose as part of your job dealing with people experiencing kind of mental health problems, the kind of legalization of assisted suicide in Canada, I think that was 2016, the law was first changed, must have had quite a significant impact in your work.
Yeah, so I've been following this issue for a long time now, ever since I was a medical student. Actually, I was in the Supreme Courthouse in 2015. for the Carter case. I skipped class. That was my last year of training in residency, and I skipped my morning class to attend that court hearing because I knew that this was going to be very significant. And I remember walking out of that courthouse not knowing what the outcome would be, but just knowing that something very significant had just happened. And then after that, 2016, that was when the Canadian government changed the law with Bill C-14 to allow for assisted suicide and euthanasia for the terminally ill, people whose death what they call was reasonably foreseeable at that time. And ever since then, we've seen this gradual expansion of the law, where in March 2021, the government expanded the law to allow for people who were not at their end of life or whose death were not reasonably foreseeable. And at that time, they also gave us 2 years, which was supposed to come up in March 2022, to also allow euthanasia and assisted suicide for those with mental illness as a sole underlying criteria. Now, this came as a bit of a surprise because when Bill C-7 first came out, the health minister had explicitly excluded mental illness as an underlying criteria, recognizing the complexity of this. But during the study, there was a lot of pressure coming from the Senate chamber to include mental illness as a eligibility criteria. Now, coming up to March 2022, we were supposed to now be able to allow this for people with solely mental illness. There was significant pushback from all 17 medical schools saying that the Canadian system was not ready for this by March 2022. There has been no training. We don't really know what we're going to do or how this is going to roll out. So the government did listen this time and said, okay, we're going to postpone this expansion to a yet undetermined date. And hopefully within this time, during this pause, before we go ahead with this, I'm hoping that this will allow us for more time to study and really consider this issue seriously. I mean, I agree that if March is just a couple of months away, and it's true that our system is definitely not right to take, is not ready to consider all the complexities of this issue to be able to roll it out. I certainly believe that there will be many lives who Canadian society had not intended to have this law applied to, who will die as a result of it. So I think the stakes are pretty weighty right now, and a significant amount of prudence and caution is needed.
So just to step back a bit, I've always been fascinated by what's been happening in Canada because, as most people know, we don't have any equivalent kind of law here in the UK, but we are also having a continual pressure here in the UK to legalise some form of medical killing. And often we're pointed towards particularly Oregon, the state of Oregon, as being the kind of ideal comparator. And of course, there are all sorts of concerns about what's going on in Oregon. But personally, I'm convinced that Canada represents a much closer model to what might happen here if a similar law was passed here. And I think that's partly because we share this kind of liberal, socialized culture. We have a very strong emphasis on the rule of law, on bureaucracy, on procedure. And we have a nationalized health service where we're very concerned, again, about procedures, protocols, care pathways, avoiding what's called, in the UK, it's called a postcode lottery, where you get different treatments depending on where you live. This is universally regarded as a bad thing. We've got to make sure that everything is standardized across the country, which of course in the States, that's a complete nonsense. The States goes exactly in the opposite way. So do you see that? I mean, would you see Canada in some way as representative of many Western liberal democratic societies?
I would say yes. There's one question that I wanted to pose to you. I don't know if you really understood how the law came to be in Canada, because this was not a democratic process, how this was enacted. Actually, Parliament has again and again sided on the side of preserving life in medicine and not allowing this. And this was only overturned because of the Supreme Court of Canada ruling that not providing assisted suicide would be discriminatory, well, actually not discriminatory, but that it was actually, it violated the constitutional freedoms of the right to life, ironically, in our country with the Charter. And so they said that this, it violated a person's ability to remain alive because, you know, that point case was, if I go back to 1993, it was super egregious with Lou Gehrig's disease. But for some people with motor neuron illnesses, they essentially become paralyzed. And so the thinking was these people may choose to end their life voluntarily with assistance or without. Actually, no, if there wasn't any assistance, they would do it on their own while they were still physically capable. And so we would deprive them of life because they would actually have lived longer if they felt that somebody could assist their death when they were no longer physically capable of doing that. So I just wanted to highlight that because it's very interesting how now if we're moving towards mental illness, this argument isn't going to apply because most people who have mental illness are not physically incapacitated to commit suicide.
Yeah, no, thanks for pointing that out. It's interesting because of exactly the same arguments that have been made here in the UK, that to say that people with motor neuron disease, with severe neurological conditions, motor neuron disease, multiple sclerosis, and so on, that they, if they come to such an advanced stage of their disease, that they are physically incapable of committing suicide, and therefore, legally, there has to be a recourse for these people to allow them to be, for a doctor to kill them effectively, because they can't kill themselves. And this case has been made repeatedly here in the UK, and it has gone to the Supreme Court, to the highest levels, but so far in the UK, the Supreme Court has said this is ultimately a matter for Parliament. There has to be, this is of such implication that there has to be a matter of primary legislation within Parliament. But there are certainly voices making the same case. So and this is often called judicial activism, isn't it? It's the idea that the judges take control because they say, you politicians, you can never get your act together. It's the judges ultimately who have to make these cases. But I think it is analogous. It's just that in the end, our judges have so far moved in a slightly different direction. But I think it could change. I mean, a Supreme Court has certainly looked at these issues and is continuing to do so. So it's fascinating to see the parallels. But when MAID was first then legalized in Canada, as you say, it didn't specifically allow euthanasia for mental illness in itself. You had to have some other condition, didn't you? You had to have some physical condition. In practice, how was that law being interpreted by physicians?
Well, I think when the law came out in 2016, so the Supreme Court punted this back to Parliament and said, we're going to remove the criminal prohibition on assisted suicide and euthanasia for, specific parameters. Parliament had to come up with, Parliament had the responsibility for coming up with what these parameters were. And so originally they felt that they needed to strike a balance between allowing for an exemption for very specific cases that were supposed to be exceptionally rare, and also protecting the public. Because I think there's a huge societal impact when we make laws that allow for the deliberate termination of life of individuals and actually allowing a physician to be able to do this with impunity. So at that time when Parliament put in this clause to say it has to be for patients whose deaths are reasonably foreseeable, this was felt to be essentially a safeguard to prevent this from being expanded to include, you know, the whole population, right? I think a lot of, you know, if you were to look at public opinion, I think there are actually a lot of people who are supportive of the original law of 2016, if you were to leave it at the end of life. That was sort of the public understanding of it and how to make it more palatable to the regular listener. However, in practice, the death being reasonably foreseeable, that wasn't actually clearly defined. There was no time period. And so the doctors could be like, well, you could be dying in, you know, in a few days versus, well, 3 months, 6 months from death, that's close enough. Your death is reasonably foreseeable. I mean, if you look at it that way, all of our deaths are reasonably foreseeable. We all know that we're going to die at one point.
And life is a terminal condition after all.
That's right. I don't think any of us have escaped that. So where do you really draw the line at that point? And it becomes really subject to the assessment of that individual physician making that determination of what is acceptable and what is not. And there is a huge spectrum of opinions on what this could be. So all a person would need to do is find a group of physicians who are a little bit more lax and liberal or lenient in their ideas of what would be acceptable. And then this, even this safeguard that they had tried to implement at the very beginning, it doesn't hold a lot of water.
I'm really interested in this because, as you say, I did a little bit of reading a few years ago about how the medical assistance in dying, or MAID as we're probably going to call it, laws kind of came into force. And as you say, it was similar to the UK. It was a series of kind of quite tragic cases of people with very serious terminal illnesses who were kind of, some of them had to travel to Switzerland, I believe, to kind of pursue assisted suicide overseas. And you know, when the question is phrased like that, quite a lot of the public feel compassion for these people and feel like maybe there should be the chance for them to take their own lives. But then as very quickly as you've been explaining, it's been expanded and expanded and is now, you know, in theory will soon be offered to people who could be young, physically healthy, experiencing, I don't know, maybe depression or schizophrenia, which are not necessarily life-limiting diseases. You know, you could live for 30, 40, 50 years experiencing depression, or you'll know better than me. How does the public respond to that expansion? Is that being driven by activists and by kind of a hardcore of committed pro-euthanasia doctors, or actually have the general Canadian public kind of move from their position of this is fine, but only for the very, very severely terminally ill?
I think that the general public has probably been caught unaware of some of the activism that is happening to pursue this expansion. And I think if you were to ask a random person on the street about what their opinion is of this, they would probably be quite shocked that we have gone this quickly and this far, seemingly without a lot of consultation. And even during the parliamentary hearings, it seemed as though the side that had concerns about further expansion were not really taken seriously. We've had many disability advocates, psychiatric professionals, doctors who have voiced their concerns about the impact of expansion on appropriate service provision for the lives of vulnerable patients who do not have access to housing, for example, who are living in financial poverty. So all of these social determinants of health that can drive a person's desire to have a hastened death because they're living a painful life and they want to have an escape from that, which is essentially what suicide is about, the law does not adequately protect. And as you've seen in some media cases that have come out, there have been people who have been driven by social poverty to receive MAID. And I find that absolutely appalling. that in a country that is supposed to be civilized and developed and has a social system to help people who are disadvantaged, that we would be quicker to offer death as a solution to these people rather than coming together as a community to try to provide the care that these people need.
And it's interesting, isn't it? Because there are so many facets of this, what's going on. I mean, one thing that occurs to me is just how difficult it is to write a law which can encompass all the different possible variations and so on. And it's interesting, when you look at different countries that have legalized some form of medical killing, you know, around the world, they've all got slightly different wordings about, you know, hopeless and unbearable suffering, or about a terminal condition, or assisting the dying process, or they say you've got to have less than six months to live. They all reflect the fact that in reality, it's actually almost impossible to write a law which is watertight, which actually provides appropriate concern. So I think that's one interesting thing just about medical law in general. It does seem like Canada is a textbook case. Once mm-hmm. you get this law written, then all the lawyers get together and say, well, reasonably foreseeable. Now, how could we interpret mm-hmm. that? And, mm-hmm. you know, and mm-hmm. how long did this person live? Now we've got case law that says that this person received it. So if that person received it, then this person, and so on. The lawyers get to work, and it's almost impossible, isn't it? But I think just the other thing I wanted to flag up is that it's very interesting to me that we've now live in a sort of social culture where pain and suffering is seen as entirely negative. It doesn't have any kind of positive or even redemptive or other aspects. It is simply utterly destructive, utterly mm-hmm. negative. Mm-hmm. And the most important thing is to stop it happening. Mm-hmm. And if that means that sadly you need mm-hmm. to give a lethal injection to this person in terrible social circumstances, so be it. At least it stops the suffering.
Yeah, so I'll just respond to that previous comment and then your second comment. But I think what you said just illustrates that, you know, some of these cases that are very exceptional and they really highlight the human experience of suffering, and then using death as a solution to justify death in those situations. I think what's happening in Canada, it highlights the fact that even though a lot of the arguments have been based on these very rare exceptional cases, when you try to apply this as a blanket policy to the population as a whole, it can have very serious unintended consequences. And you're right, it's very difficult to craft a law that can take into account all of the nuances. Even within mental health, there are certain conditions that should be treated differently from others simply by the nature of it. And I think especially in mental health, when we do not have a clear understanding of some of the pathophysiology behind some of the ways the patients present, we need to proceed very cautiously. So I've been furthering my training in learning more about trauma and the effects of that. And there's a disorder called dissociative identity disorder, for example, or just dissociations in general, where because of past traumas, a person may, you know, part of their personality actually splits off, and they may say and do things that they actually do not remember after the fact as a protective mechanism. So how much of this is like, a physiological phenomena? How do we really understand this? How does the mind actually work to allow a person to present this way? And if we, even as a psychiatrist, I'm only starting to touch the tip of the iceberg about some of these things. And so how can you expect somebody who is not trained, or even somebody within psychiatry, to be honest, I didn't have a lot of training in my residency training program about some of these things, and we are making so many advances every year just to learn more about these things. We're learning new things all the time. But if you are not aware that this is a phenomenon that could happen, somebody could be presenting before you who has expressed suicidal ideations, but this could be simply a part of them when they're dysregulated, that is expressing that. So if you're just doing a, you know, cross-sectional assessment of this person, you could be missing a lot of things, right? Especially if you're not aware that this could be happening. Borderline personality, for example, it's very alarming to me that I think in the Netherlands, they had done a study, and there were people with personality disorders who were approved for an assisted death. And I remember doing a talk once about these issues, and somebody came up to me after to thank me for my talk, and she told me that she actually had borderline personality disorder. And she was glad that I had mentioned this in the talk, because she's lived through experiences where on certain days, she just really wants to die. Mm-hmm. And in that mm-hmm. moment, nothing would have convinced her that living was still worth it. Mm-hmm. And so we know that there are these fluctuations in how a person presents that are different in specific mental illnesses compared to other mental illnesses. And so to try to treat all of these different presentations in the same way is very difficult to do. And second, well, then I was going to respond to the second comment about, you know, sort of losing the meaning about suffering, that we need to eliminate suffering, that suffering itself is something terrible and we should never tolerate that. And I just want to share a personal story that I had when I was in high school and undergrad, university. I had a very close family friend who himself was diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's disease, or ALS, which is a neurodegenerative disorder, actually the same disorder that Sue Rodriguez had in the 1993 Supreme Court case in Canada. And so eventually what this illness does is it paralyzes the person so that they're no longer able to move their voluntary muscles. And I started to visit this individual. He was very bright. He was a professor at the university. But I recognized that he was going through a very difficult time, obviously. He was losing his physical ability to function to the point where, towards the end, he could not even speak. So he was communicating to me using technology where he could tap out letters with his eyes and it would be fed through a text-to-speech. And so this required a lot of patience to allow him to take that time to communicate. And I often wondered today, if he had been alive today, and, you know, the political context is the way that it is, and he could have opted for an assisted death, I wonder what he would have chosen. But I know from my experience with him that even in that state, he was very committed to his wife. He was still able to oversee the household. He was still learning languages, Spanish. Even towards the end, his mind was still sharp, and he still found ways of wanting to continue living and still making the most out of that time. And this experience for me, where I would visit him every week throughout my university experience, was so profoundly moving for me. And it had such a big impact on my life to know that somebody who was facing something, you know, medically and physically, would, for most people, would be horrifying, right? But I learned so much from him that even when life seems really unbearable, and when you're facing insurmountable challenges, that it is still possible to find reasons to continue living. And he would not have been able to teach me this message had he not walked that experience, right?
Absolutely.
And I think, you know, as a physician, having had these experiences, as a psychiatrist, it's part of my job to be able to help people in a creative way to find meaning in their life suffering, to find reasons for continuing to live despite their circumstances. Their circumstances might not change externally, but the shift that we can have internally is what can make the difference for some people between wanting to choose to live and losing hope and wanting to die.
I was going to say, I found it really fascinating and concerning, I think, hearing you talk about earlier about kind of suicide ideation in certain mental health conditions, which, you know, is not an uncommon symptom of people experiencing mental health problems, as you'll know much better than me. And I guess what is kind of so remarkable to me watching what's happening in Canada is that maybe as recently as 10 years ago, there was a kind of tacit assumption in society that while we have compassion for people who are feeling suicidal as a result of mental health problems, we always believe firmly for them that suicide is not the right thing to do, and that as a society we will work to try and
protect them from themselves, bluntly. And that was a kind of conviction that went back probably thousands of years, probably, across most of the kind of Western world, at least, that no matter how much kind of torment and anguish you're in, and no matter how much to the individual taking their own life was the best way out of it, we as a society, and certainly doctors, had a job to say, actually, you know, it might feel unsustainable, but I'm here to tell you that it can get better, and that there is options, and you have options. And now that's kind of, in a heartbeat, is gone, because, you know, you could have someone who was having a very severe bout of depression. They go and see a doctor, and rather than the doctor kind of protecting them from themselves, they can have no confidence that the doctor will say, all right, well, we'll assess you for MAID, get that done in a fortnight, and you could be dead by the end of the month.
Yes, I mean, this is definitely a concern, and one of the reasons why I feel like if this is something that society wants, you know, as assisted death, I don't think that it should be integrated into the medical profession itself. In order to create those safe spaces for patients so that they know what to expect when they see their healthcare professional, that they're not going to be induced in a moment of weakness to believing that suicide is an appropriate solution to their life suffering, when their physician may be the only, you know, consistent support that they could have. And I think as a medical professional, it's, you know, I've drawn a line in the sand to say, this is a line that I must not cross, because I'm actually quite aware of the vulnerabilities of physicians as human beings to know how it feels to feel helpless in the face of suffering. And it is so easy to cross that line and say, I totally get where you're coming from, and I feel like I don't have a solution for you. And so just to cross that line and to help you end it, that is very seriously tempting. And there's something called a countertransference that we study in psychiatry. And this is how the patient makes the therapist feel. And so oftentimes, a patient that's coming in feeling super depressed and super hopeless, the therapist themselves can then start to feel helpless and hopeless. And so how much of the physician's acquiescence to a patient's request to assist them to die comes from unknown countertransference that we may not be aware of? So, you know, I think that there needs to be other factors involved if society is going to do this. Like, you shouldn't just leave it up to that individual physician to make that determination because of these power differentials, right? And so that is the reason why you need to have at least two assessors to do this, just to make sure that the physician themselves are not biased.
This podcast is an outreach of Premier Insight and can only come to you each week through the support of listeners like you. Your support today is so important that we want to thank you for your gift by giving you a copy of Premier Insight's brand new ebook on artificial intelligence called The Robot Race. In it, two experts in AI and robotics discuss the implications of AI technology and explore what we can learn about the human race in the light of AI's growing capabilities. You'll gain insights into how your Christian faith can inform your view of this world-changing technology and its implications on your life and the future of humanity. Again, this ebook is our thanks to you for your gift in support of this program to help equip more Christians to confidently discuss their faith as it intersects with every aspect of life. To get your copy of The Robot Race, simply go to premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. Thank you for your support.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Sophora, I wanted to dig a bit more into your experience as a psychiatrist working in this kind of new normal in Canada. Does it come up often in your day-to-day work? Do you find patients either kind of asking you for MAID or colleagues recommending that this patient or that patient might be eligible?
Well, because the law has not yet expanded yet to include mental illness legally, so the requests have not been coming in, to that extent yet. But I do know that I have some patients who are already contemplating it and have asked me about it. And so I will speak to them because I want to understand their underlying reasons for why they're wanting to access medical assistance in dying, or MAID is an acronym that we use in Canada. I usually approach this as any other request, when we assess for suicidal ideations in patients and they respond affirmatively, I still have a duty as a psychiatrist to understand what that is. And my approach is that a request for medical assistance in dying is an expression of somebody's suicidal ideations. And so the first step to do that is just to try to understand what their underlying distress is and see if we can address those things. And oftentimes what I hear is this overwhelming sense of loneliness and isolation, fear of the unknown, fear of not being supported, fear of losing the support of their caregivers, and what are they going to do? And I've had conversations like this, and I suggested, well, what if we can help you with some of these things? What if we can help you to find some supportive living, and people can help you with paying the bills and the finances and ensure that your needs are taken care of and that you can eat? Would that change your mind? And oftentimes it would. They would sort of retract their desire to continue accessing an assisted death. Unfortunately, with this law now coming down the pipes and patients becoming aware of it, are saying, well, I'm just going to wait until the law changes and then I'm going to access it anyway. And they're speaking in a time when they're feeling emotionally distressed. And I've heard some of my patients say to me, if medical assistance in dying was not available for mental illness, then yes, I would try these other supports first. But if it was available, I think I would just rather opt for an assisted death before trying these alternative routes. And the concerning thing about the Canadian law is that patients do not have a legal, it's not mandated legally that they try all available treatments. They could decline treatment. For example, someone who has cancer does not want to receive chemotherapy and still be made eligible for an assisted death. And if you apply this to mental illness, it becomes even more concerning that we would offer essentially an assisted suicide if a patient has declined certain standard treatments. Now, obviously, that's not the policy that we want to be enacting, but legally, from a legal perspective, there's nothing that could stop a patient from accessing a medically assisted death if their physician, so again, this is the subjective determination of the assessor, feels like it would be appropriate for that patient to decline treatment and still access a medically assisted death. So I think this is the reason why there needs to be stricter and better standards to guide, and this is currently missing in the Canadian legal context.
And could you say what's happening in your own hospital outside of the psychiatric areas, in the areas where there may be patients with cancer or with motor neurone disease we talked about last week, who feel that their life is not worth living, and who are physicians routinely raising this as an option? Are they waiting for the patient to raise this? How is it actually working in practice?
So I think this is an area that's a bit contentious, because do bear in mind that under the law, it is still a crime to sort of persuade somebody to end their life, as a suicide,
to assist a suicide.
As an assisted suicide. The law carved out that it's legal under certain parameters. So how do you interpret this within like a clinical setting then? If a physician is going to raise this unsolicited, how much of that is perceived or experienced by the patient as someone that is encouraging their suicide. And so I'm not going to speak for my hospital specifically, but we do know that patients have had experiences where physicians have raised the option of medically assisted death unsolicited. And I guess there's two different views on this, but I know at our college level, like the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario, which grants physicians our license to practice, they recently had a consultation on medical assistance in dying. And if you read the policy that they're consulting on, it's very clear that they sort of expect, they quoted a CAMAP, so that CAMAP is the Canadian, I forget what it stands for, but it's the Association of Canadian Physicians that provide, made, and assess for medically assisted death. But that document very strongly recommended that that physicians do initiate the discussion and to put medically assisted death on the table, even without the patients soliciting it or inquiring about it, if the physician felt that this was an appropriate, like, you know, if they met the legal criteria for it, and that it was appropriate that the physician themselves should raise it. So this raises many more new concerns about how this would affect the patient-physician dynamic. I mean, if you were the father of a child who, you know, above the age of 18, an adult, but had a mental illness and was severely depressed, and you took them to see your family doctor or the psychiatrist, and you're expecting that the physician is going to try to help your daughter, and the physician turns around and, you know, depending on the trajectory of your daughter's case, then proposing that assisting in her suicide would be an appropriate response to her suffering, I think most parents would be rightly concerned that this could be a scenario that they would face. If you add on another disability to your daughter's presentation, you know, maybe she got in a car accident and she's suffering from a traumatic brain injury. You know, this could happen to any of us. How does a physician who is working in a system where medically assisted death is legal then perceive the quality of life or the value of the life of your daughter? What if she was paraplegic, you know? How much easier is it then to suggest, well, it looks like you're suffering a lot, you do have depression and you are suicidal and you're clearly telling me that you want to die. Why don't we consider that as a possibility?
And I think it illustrates again this extraordinary difficulty about the law and operating within a legal framework, because the situation is exactly analogous to what happens in the UK concerning abortion, where if the patient meets the criteria for an abortion, because, for instance, the unborn baby, the fetus, has some kind of abnormality, and if the obstetrician fails to inform the patient that they meet the law, then the obstetrician will be sued, or may be sued, can be sued, by the patient subsequently that they were not informed. So once an option, a medical option becomes legally available, there becomes an implicit duty. You have to tell the patient. So the analogous situation would be, I've got cancer, I've got terrible pain, I go to see my physician tells me about all this pain relief medication and so on, but fails to tell me that I could have euthanasia, that I could be killed, even though I do meet. And it's only a year later that I discover that I could have been had the euthanasia a year ago. I can then sue the physician because I've had a year of additional pain that I didn't know anything about. So this is the problem, isn't it?
And that was actually incorporated into the policy, and I'm not sure that whoever crafted the policy was necessarily thinking about, you know, how this would affect patients who have mental illness. They said that you need to inform them or even like make a referral for a medically assisted death in a timely fashion, essentially to reduce any further unnecessary suffering, I guess. However, when we're dealing with psychiatric illnesses or even, you know, brain injuries, the time to recover takes time. There's no other way around it. And oftentimes, if you're trying to overcome a mental illness and going through the recovery route, the experience of that is painful. Sometimes things have to get worse before it feels better. And doing that work, facing and confronting things that we've tried to keep suppressed and buried and just rather not think about, it's tough. And many people would say, who suffer from both a physical illness and an emotional or psychological illness, would say that I can deal with the physical pain, but the psychological suffering is really the thing that undoes me. And so I don't want to minimize psychological suffering because it is very painful, you know. And but I still question whether the approach to helping somebody experience that distress and helping them through it, whether our approach to offer death as a solution is the best solution. Well, the thing is, if the colleges expect us to provide a medically assisted death in a timely manner, we are not allowing patients the time that they would need to actually recover. So how many patients would we be, you know, ending their lives unnecessarily when they could have had a chance to recover if we had just given them that time and be able to help them to bear that suffering in that time with the hope that they are going to get through this. And we know that to be able to predict accurately that the person in front of you who's suffering from a mental illness is not going to get better, to be able to make that determination, we can't. It's guesswork. Right? Mm-hmm. So the way that the law is crafted is in order to be eligible for an assisted death, you have to make the determination that the illness that the person is experiencing is irremediable. That is the key term. But we actually don't have any ability to determine accurately that a person with mental illness has an irremediable illness. And I was saying to your dad earlier, I can't predict that in my patients. There are some who have been considering having a medically assisted death, and then a year later they come back to me. Nothing has really changed externally in their circumstances, but with all the time that has been invested in helping them to learn more about themselves, to become more accepting, to be more self-compassionate, internally they experienced a shift and they recognized that there was still meaning and purpose in their life. And that they didn't have to be, you know, perceived as a burden, that they still had something to offer. And that shifted them from wanting to die to then finding new reason to live. But that took about a year for them to get to that level. And all I did as a psychiatrist was just simply to be there with them, to witness to their suffering, to hold a safe space for them so that they could work through these things internally. And that was what made the difference. Can I predict that this is going to happen? I can't. Some patients might not reach that, or they might need 10 years in order to reach that stage. As a physician, I don't have a crystal ball to tell me what is going to happen.
That's right. And certainly working as a doctor, you see that time and time again, don't you? That how utterly unpredictable the future is, how people can change. Diseases, both physical and psychiatric, can change dramatically. And this idea that we can say, oh, this one is hopeless, we absolutely know this is irredeemable. Again, irremediable. It doesn't make sense, does it, when we're actually practicing on the ground?
Yeah, and what kind of messaging does that give to our patients, too, if the physician is expected to say, I can assist you with an earlier death? Does that not imply that you have kind of given up and that the physician themselves has lost hope that they're going to get better? I mean, that's a pretty devastating message to receive. If I was a patient, I would like my physician to be firmly grounded and say, like, no matter what happens, I'm going to walk with you through this. We'll keep working on this together. That would give me hope. To be given the message, well, if all else fails, then I can just help you to end your life. That's not very hope-inspiring.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
I wanted to pick up on something you mentioned earlier, which was that you decided in yourself as a psychiatrist that you weren't going to recommend MAID for any of your patients. You didn't believe that it was the kind of compassionate thing to do as their physician. How is that decision, is that decision possible? Do you have the right of conscientious objection? Are you obliged to kind of hand a patient over to a more pro-MAID colleague of yours? And how is the kind of college in Ontario responding to doctors like yourself who are trying to opt out of the whole system?
So that's an excellent question. Within the law, I mean, there's the preamble to Bill C-14. It said that no doctor should who doesn't want to be involved in these procedures, they don't need to be. However, the way that the colleges have framed their expectations is that even if you have a conscientious objection to being implicated in medically assisted death in terms of, you know, inserting the lethal syringe yourself, we still have a duty to refer our patient who is requesting this to a colleague who would be able to provide for that service. And so this is something that we've been trying to fight in court unsuccessfully. The court actually did not, so this was the Court of Ontario, did not rule on the issue of conscience, but only on religion, and said that even if a physician has religious beliefs that indicate they have moral objections to euthanasia and assisted suicide, it's okay to infringe upon the religious beliefs of the physicians because the patient's rights take precedent. And so they didn't actually talk about conscience per se, but my response to that would be, why are you enacting policies that suppress the conscience of physicians? Conscience being what one knows or believes to be right and wrong. And so what are the policy implications of this if you're telling physicians that they must suppress their judgment about what is right and wrong, and encourage them to do something that they believe is bad for their patients or wrong? This, at a very fundamental core level, is something that puts patients' safety at risk. And so at this point, it really becomes an individual question then for the physician. How do they expect to carry themselves under these circumstances, and how are they going to choose to respond when the college is expecting them to do something that they believe is morally reprehensible?
And do you think if the government were to pass this further amendment to allow medical killing, euthanasia, in cases of pure mental illness without any other physical problem, how do you feel personally, Savora? Do you think it's going to be possible for you and for other psychiatrists who believe as you do to carry on practicing in your position? Is it putting you in an impossible position? I mean, I know that's a pretty hard question to ask, but what's your thinking about it?
So, you know, when I first graduated, I had thought of working in psychosocial oncology, actually, because I saw the value in journeying with people even to the very end and helping to prepare people for a good death in terms of working out all the psychological kinks that they might have. I decided not to pursue that just because when I graduated in 2015, I knew that this law was coming down, and I thought, well, to work in palliative care, I would just be walking into the lion's den at that point. And I would probably have to face these scenarios a lot more frequently. So let's just do general psychiatry. But you know, you can't run away from these things. So it has, the issue has pursued me even in my profession. And to be honest, it's very tempting to say, you know, I'm just going to give up. I don't want to have to deal with this. Why not just work in another profession like therapy, you know, as counseling? The only reason why I have a legal ability to end a person's life is because of my medical license. And if that's the case, and I didn't go into medicine to kill people, why would I want to continue working in this? And I have colleagues who have left the province of Ontario originally when this law came out, and they were really unfriendly towards people who had issues of conscience about this. I've had colleagues who have left. I've had colleagues who have stopped working in palliative care. I've had colleagues who have retired early because they don't want to have to deal with this. But, you know, I'm still early in my career. I still have a long ways to go. And I think giving up would just be taking the easy way out. And so I do intend to continue working in this field as long as it's possible. If my license isn't taken away from me, I don't want to stop working. I believe that my work is meaningful and that I am making a difference in people's lives. And some of my patients who had previously considered a medically assisted death thanked me and said, "Thank you for the work that you're doing. You are literally saving lives." Sometimes I don't even realize the impact that I'm having, but when I hear the feedback like this from some of my patients and I recognize how important it was for me to be there in order to help them or to facilitate that internal shift that they had, I recognize that the work that I am doing is important. And so I do intend to continue and work in the system and try to make it better, right? And how can we change the culture so that people also realize the reasons why I believe what I believe and why I approach clinical care the way I do? I do this because I believe that it is better for the patients. It's better for society. It's better for our communities. That's why I do it, and I'll try to continue doing this as long as I can.
It's great to hear, and I'd really support and encourage you to do that. You know, in a Christian context, we're called to be salt and light in a society, and why I think those two metaphors are so encouraging is that actually you only need a tiny bit of salt to have a huge preservative influence. And you only need a tiny bit of light to illuminate an awful lot of darkness. So the fact that as Christians who are trying to uphold the value of human life, we may feel like a tiny minority, doesn't mean that we can't have actually an influence outside much greater than we might imagine. I mean, one of the things we're talking about in the UK is if a law like this was passed, would it be possible to create euthanasia-free zones? Would it be possible, for instance, to have clinics which were publicly stated that we don't offer euthanasia, it's a safe place? You know, would it be possible to have hospitals, independent mm-hmm. hospitals, which preserved life and took this view?
That is a wonderful idea, and that is something that I personally would like to further advance. I know that having safe spaces and sanctuaries like this that are life-affirming is under threat because, you know, in Ontario we have Catholic hospitals that provide healthcare according to the values of the Catholic Christian faith, and so euthanasia would be very contrary to that. However, when these hospitals are publicly funded, there's a lot of pressure from the government to say, unless you do exactly what we tell you to do, and if this is a legal procedure, then you must do it, otherwise we're going to remove your funding, which has happened, by the way, at a Delta Hospice in British Columbia, where the board of directors did not want to allow euthanasia on their premises, and public funding was removed from them, and so this has been an ongoing battle. But you're right, I think if we were to have a system where euthanasia and assisted suicide is legal, patients deserve to have a place where they feel safe, an environment where they feel like they do not have to worry that their patient, that the physician is going to put unsolicited on the table an assisted death as a potential solution or treatment option for them. And I think that this is something that our society should be requesting, you know. Can we not make room for having people of both sides and for those who want to be life-affirming, that they're given the space and the safety to be able to do that without feeling like they're being discriminated against? I think in a progressive society where we're supposed to be tolerant of all different views, this is probably the least thing that we could do to be able to respect everybody's opinions on this very contentious issue.
That's absolutely right. And what's more, I have a suspicion that if it was possible to create those safe places, those institutions would turn out to be incredibly popular. I think the great, you know, mass of the public would beat a path to the door to be looked after by physicians and nurses and other professionals who they knew were committed to human life. I mean, this is not a tiny minority interest. I mean, that's the paradox, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So I think it would be possible for this threat that's coming, which is coming around the world, to actually represent a new opportunity for developing distinctively, quotes, pro-life establishments which value human life. And in some ways we're putting the clock back to many noble Christian institutions in the past.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And I mean, even if you were to look at non-Christians, like the Hippocratic Oath that we used to have to take as medical professionals, that has been changed. I don't think Hippocrates was Christian, but he recognized that there was an importance, there was a value in not intentionally ending the lives of his patients, even when he was requested to do so by the patient. And so he was living in a time when people could approach their doctors and be poisoned, or, you know, the doctors were the ones who held the knowledge of what could kill and what could save life. And so preserving that ethics of life is precious, and we will not violate that. I think he probably had a pretty successful medical practice. And so we should not forget some of these earlier tenets that, you know, Western civilization has been built upon, some of these fundamental principles. It is for the good of society. And I truly believe that if the government was adaptable enough and tolerant enough to set up some of these life-affirming sanctuaries, it would help to retain a lot of people within the medical professional, including nurses and pharmacists who went into the practice of medicine because they value life and want to protect it and preserve it. And then it would be a win for the patients as well, and their families, who feel like they have a safe place to go. So can we not just work together to build a society that is just inclusive of everybody? And I think that would actually build a much stronger society and a healthier society.
We're kind of running out of time, but before we end that, I wanted to ask just briefly, you know, we've been talking about the kind of difficult road that lies ahead for you as a Christian life-affirming doctor in Canada at the start of your career. How do you feel like the Canadian church has been engaged in this story? Do you feel kind of upheld and encouraged and supported by Christians outside of the medical world? Have Christians been engaged in the activism and, you know, now the law has changed, in work to try and mitigate, and the things we've been talking about mitigating some of the harmful effects of me?
Well, I think even within the Christian realm, there are differing views on this issue. So I wouldn't say that even within the Christian faith communities that there's necessarily consensus there either. But I would say that most of the Christian leaders that I have spoken to have been very supportive of the work that I've been doing and have been trying to provide messaging to the government to be, you know, tolerant and accepting of our views. But the Canadian government thus far has not really really taken those concerns, I believe, to heart, really. I mean, you can see by the ongoing progression and the erosion of the laws that's kind of where they're coming from. But, you know, within my own faith community, I would say that generally speaking, I feel like I've been pretty well supported. And I just want to comment on the previous comment about being light and salt. And I just really love that analogy, as salt being a preservative. And we are called to be those, the light and the salt. And just a little bit, but a little bit can go a long ways. And each of us carry a light within us. And when we come together, that light becomes even stronger and brighter. And I believe that it is in this moment in time in this history where we really need to be really authentic witnesses to what we believe to be true and good. And if we individually remain firm to that, we can make a difference. So, you know, the message is, don't be afraid. We're going to get through this. And, you know, we're called to bring hope to people. And I think we can do that when we are best authentic witnesses to what we truly believe.
Well, that's a great place to draw our conversation to a close. Thanks so much, Sephora. It's been really fascinating for me personally, and I'm sure for everyone listening to get such an insight, such a thoughtful reflection on what it's like working as a psychiatrist in Canada at the moment. Thanks so much for all your insight and generosity with your time. If anyone listening would like to kind of dig into more into these questions around euthanasia and assisted suicide, as I mentioned last week, there are plenty of resources to read on Dad's website. That's johnwyatt.com. You can get in touch with us, as always, by emailing molad@premier.org. Otherwise, we'll see you next week. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Here in America, work is in trouble. We've offshored our manufacturing, sent away good jobs, and lost so much ability to make things. American Giant is a company that's pushing back against this tide. They make high-quality clothing, sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more right here in the USA. Visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, promo code STAPLE20.